This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The economy, poverty, and jobs, jobs, jobs. So where are they at? After all, whom do they claim the recession is turning around for?
Poverty, the economy, jobs, jobs, and more jobs. But persistent high unemployment and lackluster job growth are having a profoundly damaging impact on millions of Americans, and the ranks of the unemployed continuing to swell.
For discussion on the economy, wealth, poverty, and jobs, we're joined by Avis Jones DeWeaver, Director of the Council of Negro Women's Research, Policy, and Information Center, Heidi Scherholz, labor market economist with the Economic Policy Institute.
And Imagine Louis, director of the Closing the Racist Wealth Gap Initiative. Imagine, what are we really looking at?
The growing wealth gap in our country as a whole, and just to say quickly, why does wealth matter? Because as we're talking about work and the working class, obviously people need jobs and income. But you really need to have wealth as well, and what I mean by that is you need to have assets greater than your liability, especially in tough economic times. You're not going to be able to weather the economic storm of layoffs and cutbacks in your hours of work and so on if you don't have good credit. It turns out that as bad as that disparity is in general, the gap between whites and people of color is that a family of color only owns about 15 cents compared to the white dollar. So we have an enormous racial wealth gap as well, especially for African Americans. And we still have a situation where the darker, the poorer, so that while it's bad enough for Asians, for Latinos, and so on, for African Americans, the wealth gap actually grew between 2001 and 2004. And 2004 is when we have the latest data for. In 2001, they had 12 cents to every white dollar owned by a white family, but in 2004 it had dropped to only 10 cents. And probably in the last few years, due to the foreclosure crisis, we don't even have the figures yet, but that number has probably increased again. So a dime for a dollar, that is really unconscionable in this time in the United States.
Heidi, the jobs report has come out for August, and it's abysmal. Mm-hmm. So why don't you update us on that, and also in terms of how the effect on real wages and is continuing.
And then, of course, we'll go to Avis and really complete this dismal picture.
Yeah, that's what they call economics the dismal science.
Right. There's not,
it's getting more dismal every year.
We'll get more dismal as the time goes by. I'll just do a brief recap of what we saw in the August numbers. We lost 216,000 jobs in August. I mean, we're still losing hundreds of thousands of jobs, 200,000 jobs a month, but it's better than it was. In the depths of the winter, in the first quarter of this year, we were losing nearly 700,000 jobs a month. So the losses are moderating. That's due almost entirely to the recovery package. That's the thing we can thank for the moderating losses, for sort of pulling us back from the abyss. But the fact that we're still losing 200,000 jobs a month means that unemployment is still rising. So unemployment rose to 9.7%. It's on its steady upward march. There's no way we'll be able to avoid getting up over 10% within the next few months, certainly by the end of the year. And in certain populations, we are already over 10%. So amongst men, unemployment 10.9%. Men have been harder hit by this recession due to their concentration in highly cyclical industries like manufacturing and construction. Amongst black workers, the unemployment rate is 15.1%. Amongst Hispanics, it's 13.0%. Young workers are also hit harder. Unemployment, 18.2% for workers age 24 or younger. Mm. So this overall unemployment rate of 9.7% really masks the fact that there's subgroups in this economy that are at depression-level unemployment rates. And that is actually going to last for a very long time. Unemployment will continue to rise for at least the next year. So we are hearing all this stuff about the economy is actually turning around, and that is, in many respects, true. GDP, the overall value of goods and services produced in the country, industrial production, those things are starting to turn around, and it's possible that by the end of this year, even possibly by the end of this quarter, the macroeconomy will no longer be contracting. But it will not immediately start growing fast enough that it will be generating jobs growth healthy enough to start bringing the unemployment rate down. The unemployment rate is going to continue to rise for at least another year. I think it will probably peak out about a year from now, maybe at 10.4%. We will have so much ground to make up at that point. We are going to have elevated unemployment for probably another 4 or 5 years. So the working families of this country are in for an extraordinarily long haul before we're out of this thing.
Honey, just quickly, you were talking about unemployment at about 10%, but that's only one measure. Some people are saying that if you include underemployment and also people that have left the labor force because they can't find jobs, it's at least 20, 30% higher.
Yeah, that those
20 or 30%.
It's interesting. Here's the thing. You can't capture something, a system as complex as the U.S. labor market, with one number. The unemployment rate is a very useful statistic. But in order to be counted as officially unemployed, you have to be actively seeking work. So it doesn't count people who have knocked on every door in their town 10 times and just aren't going back right now until things start to pick up. So we have other measures that also include these discouraged workers or people that have a job but they can't get the hours that they want, so their paychecks are really cut back because they can't find the hours. There's a sort of so-called underemployment rate that is more comprehensive, that includes those other groups. Right now, that's at 16.8%. So by that more comprehensive measure, 1 in 6 U.S. worker is either unemployed or underemployed.
The issue of already existing poverty and where the wage disparity, the income and wealth disparity that Maejun described, the unemployment statistics, which are devastating, that Heidi described, how do these actually play out in the work that you do, Avis?
The poorest of the poor still are invisible today, for the most part, and still are suffering really at elevated levels, but oftentimes suffering somewhat silently, in that most of us can go about our day-to-day activities and not really realize the level of despair that many of our neighbors are living in on a day-to-day basis. For example, that in the midst of all of this rising unemployment, record levels, we're at like a 26-year high, for example, in unemployment, that, of course, more and more people are becoming discouraged and falling into poverty. How does that play out in the lives of people? For one thing, the latest poverty numbers haven't been released yet, so we can't say specifically how much has gone up since the recession. And even when the latest numbers are released, it's not going to really tell us how bad things are now, because those will just be the 2008 numbers, and things have deteriorated significantly since 2008. But some of the indicators that we can look at are things like food stamp usage, which are extremely high, hitting record levels across the nation. Now we know about some 32 million people across America are relying on food stamps just to be able to put food on the table on a day-to-day basis. We know that homelessness is rising starkly in this country. Here in the richest country in the world, we have literally tents cities popping up in this nation. That is something that most people could find jarring. But unfortunately, it's something that we have allowed to continue to happen. All of this is happening within the midst and within an environment in which we've seen welfare reform continue, so that our safety net is much more tattered now to deal with these huge increases in despair that we're seeing across this nation than we would have been in past recessions. As a result of that, one might expect to see more literal suffering across the nation. And we see this in a time where actually we see states doing the counterintuitive things, where instead of increasing the welfare rolls in times in which you would see increase in needs, we're seeing many, many states actually cutting people from the welfare rolls. Some of the latest numbers suggest that some 18 states have actually cut their welfare rolls over the course of this recession. But we're still working within an environment where, in terms of the policy design of welfare reform, there are still incentives built in for states to keep those welfare rolls as low as possible, rather than really to meet the needs that continue to surface and that continue to peak even in this time of economic turmoil. So until we change our dynamic in terms of our policy priorities with regards to really meeting the real needs of people, even in their desperate times, these people will continue to be invisible. What they do is they end up living with family, living with friends, living in overcrowded situations, maybe being in the tent cities that I spoke of earlier. But the bottom line is there's lots of needs out there that continues to go unmet.
Mejun?
To build on what Avis was saying in terms of populations that really are invisible and have been for a long time, the poorest people in this country are actually Asian. The poverty rate among the Hmong is about 60%, and for Cambodians about 40%, but nobody really has paid attention to this kind of data. Unemployment on Native American reservations reaches like 90% in some cases, and yet nobody pointed to a recession or depression until it hit the white community as well. So I think we really do have to lift up these different groups. And just a comment, too, in terms of the great mismatch and just a caveat, a word of caution about GDP. GDP rises, but it doesn't really tell how things are distributed. So, for example, when the government injected a lot of money into New Orleans after Katrina, GDP went up, but it didn't help at all the people that were losing their homes and still have not regained those homes. It did help people in Blackwater Security and Halliburton and things like that. So, again, distribution is something that we really have to be careful to examine and not just to look at those global numbers. And in terms of homelessness, too, I'm just thinking how stupid our system is when we have all of these houses that are standing empty and yet we have a rising homeless population, but somehow we can't figure out how to put the people into the houses. We really need to be thinking about the complete mismatch that's going on in our society right now.
Heidi, do you want to bounce off that discussion about growing poverty? And also, I know that the EPI had a report recently on stagnant or decreasing real wages in the population.
Mm-hmm.
Is everybody going to get poorer?
Yeah, and one thing that was said earlier is the idea of our safety net not doing its job right now. We have increasingly in the last 15 years passed legislation that has tied our safety net more and more and more to work. Welfare to work requirements, the earned income tax credit is a huge and really important anti-poverty tool, but it's tied to work. And what does that mean when we have a safety net that is completely tied to work and there are no jobs? It's a safety net set up for a booming economy. And if the economy falters as it is right now, what does that mean for the poor of our country? And that's a question that I don't have an answer to. It's not clear to me what these families are going to do when we don't have a safety net that's there for people in the absence of jobs.
I want to just punctuate the point that Heidi just made. That is so true, and it's so disturbing. What's particularly frightening is that not only will she not know, none of us will know, because the states are not required to collect data to find out what happens to people once they are lost from the role. So we can't track these people oftentimes, and that's why they're invisible. And so it's easy to sort of ignore a problem when that problem is not being captured correctly and therefore can't really be characterized as accurately as would be possible if you were to capture that data. That's something that needs to be changed. We need to know what's happening to people who cannot fulfill these requirements and therefore are being sanctioned and therefore being dropped off the rolls. What happens next? What happens to their children? What happens to their families? That's something that we need to be able to document so that we can then say, let's do something about this. We have proof that these people are suffering. Let's now do something about it.
This is Maeju again, and just to build on Avis's remarks, too, for people of color, especially, and Avis and I are both part of a network of experts of color, one of our big demands is simply for data broken down by race because it's so hard to make our case without appropriate data. But I did want to say something a little bit more positive. Rather than just thinking about income support programs, which we have only had for the last 30 or 40 years, I mean, what I'm saying is we have only had programs that provide income support to people who are in very tough times with the assumption that they will get jobs sooner than later. So that's true of unemployment, it's true of welfare and other things. But what we need to get back to is thinking about how do we put in place asset building programs. So in terms of the last depression, you had the Federal Housing Authority created and low-interest mortgages were made available. So it's a little bit counterintuitive to think about the fact that when jobs and income are low that we should be thinking about assets, but we really need to think about them together because I think that with those help with getting ownership of homes and building up your equity, those things were responsible for building the middle class a little bit later on. Of course, we know that the flaw in that was that those programs were not made available to everyone. People of color were left out. But with that large caveat, still the idea of providing asset building incentives by the government and not just income support is something that we need to look at as a way to get our economy moving again for the people at the very bottom of the ladder.
And the reason why assets is so important is that it not only can serve as the bridge for brief periods of unemployment, but it's also important, particularly in times like this when we've established that the broader social safety net is very much inadequate. In times like these, that's when individuals and families have to rely on familial safety net. I may have lost my home, but perhaps my aunt has hers, or perhaps my mom has hers, and therefore we can go there. When you're in a situation where literally millions of families have lost their homes, as we've seen over the past couple of years, then those familial safety nets begin to take a hit. And so unless we begin to shore up those sorts of barriers or those sorts of bridges to some sort of opportunity or some sort of way to turn the corner when one is facing tough times, we really have no options left for families that are just now really struggling and flailing on their own.
So what needs to be done? Somebody jump in here and tell us what the president needs to do, what the states needs to do, what kind of policies do we need to do at this point?
Well, there's a couple of things. I'll just start off. There's more than one way to be employed. Rather than finding a job, people often start their own businesses. And micro-enterprise and very small businesses are a hidden piece of our economy that really is a very important one. So, for example, by micro-enterprise, I mean one that has less than 5 employees and needs only $35,000 or less to get it started. Right now, there are almost 3 million U.S. businesses that really have no payroll. So in some ways, while we say it's a business, it's really a worker working for themselves. And out of those, over 4 million are minority firms. It's something that is done a lot in communities of color. And that has generated about 8 million jobs for the person who's starting the business. And some of them do have, like I said, a small number of employees. And one thing that RRA did do was it did put aside more money for micro-enterprise and helping people to get started with their businesses, giving them the technical assistance that's required as well for that kind of thing. So I think sort of not thinking in terms of just what is the huge industry that we're going to start that's going to be the solution, green or otherwise, I think we have to look again at micro-enterprises, and often they're very important because they fill unfulfilled niches in communities that are often marginalized from the larger society.
And Heidi, do you have any thoughts? Because one of the things that's been amazing to Ken and I as we really looked around is people are talking about another stimulus package, mm-hmm. granted, but very little meat within that and very little actual proposal that we can garner mass support around for the creation of jobs.
That's a very good point. As we enter what people are going to start calling a recovery, this GDP starts expanding, what we know is that the labor market is going to continue to falter for a very long time. It's absolutely essential that we do not pull back on any of the stimulus spending that we've done so far, and we need to actually do more. States in total are $200 billion in the red. So we need to shore up state balance sheets. We know that states have balanced budget requirements, and so as their revenues are falling, as they are right now, if the federal government doesn't do something to shore up their balance sheets, that they're going to have no choice but to either increase taxes or cut spending, both of which will put further drains on the economy, further lost jobs. We need to extend unemployment insurance benefits. We need to expand safety nets to help the people that are most hurt by this downturn. So I don't think there's any political will in this town, and I'm sitting in Washington, D.C. right now, to actually go through with another big stimulus package like the one we had, but more piecemeal spending to fix holes where possible is going to be absolutely required. So that's what we're going to need to do in the short term to make sure that the recovery moves forward when it starts to take hold. And then we know that we are going to have areas, pockets, communities in this country that have depression-level unemployment that's going to last for years to come. And we need to start thinking very seriously about direct jobs creation programs in those areas. No one is talking about it. No one is talking about what can we do in these pockets of incredibly high unemployment that we know is going to last for years. But I think we need to start thinking really carefully about that. The stimulus package was not a government jobs program. It was about getting money into the economy that we have and stimulating it. I mean, there was lots of talk at the time it was passed of less than 10% of the jobs created by the stimulus are going to be government jobs. That stimulus package was partly passed as this is not government hiring people. We need to think about actually doing something right, like a direct jobs creation program for the medium term. And then for the long term, once a recovery starts to take hold, we need to think about the things that have led to dramatically increasing inequality for decades. Things like declining unionization. We need to pass the Employee Free Choice Act to start turning that around. We need the erosion of the real value of the minimum wage. We need to get the minimum wage so it is at a higher level so it has the power to lift up the whole bottom half of the income distribution. We need to think more in smarter ways about globalization so that it's not simply exposing our lower wage workers to much lower wage workers around the globe. When you think longer term, you have to go to all of these different labor market institutions and globalization policies that have really created this big and increasing gap in income between the low and the high.
And I'm, Avis, totally, really at a loss. I don't know where the jobs come from. I don't see any application and creation for the numerous youth within our communities or those people who have recently graduated. Where in the world are those jobs to come? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree with Heidi in that we need to really think seriously about what sort of major job creation we can do as a federal program in this nation to put people back to work. That needs to be the top priority. We cannot be satisfied with a jobless recovery. That is no real recovery at all. We've been there. We've done that. We don't want to go through that again. And so I would love to see this administration is very much in favor of investing a lot in this green jobs ideology. And I personally am a believer in green jobs in terms of the possibility of that being a way of not only producing jobs of the future, jobs that are good for the climate, jobs that are good, better paying jobs, but also jobs that cannot be shipped overseas. What we need to do is to make sure that those jobs, though, are found in every neighborhood, not just in certain neighborhoods, so that they are also available in low-income neighborhoods that are also available to people of color. I was personally quite heartbroken to find out that Van Jones had submitted his resignation. I'm a big fan of his. I think that he has a strong track record of demonstrating that he understands how to make sure that disadvantaged people are trained for jobs that would not just get them working, but get them working at a level in which they're making above poverty level wages. What people need are training in a field that will provide above poverty level wages and jobs that are located in their neighborhoods, along with the supports that they need to be able to go back and forth into that job, like transportation, childcare assistance, things of that nature. So we really need to think of this in a very holistic way. I wish there was some way that we could get stand back, but in the absence of that, I think that we should not be satisfied with anyone less than a similar commitment that he has demonstrated over the years in terms of filling that void in the future.
Once again, in some ways, the Civilian Conservation Corps during the Depression years was a green jobs program. It built some of our national parks and rebuilt some of our infrastructure. So there's still much to learn from that period of time. But when I look at people right now who are so virulently against a public option, even in health care, for our government to create a big government jobs program, it will take all of us doing our utmost to really fight that tide of sentiment of, like, labeling President Obama and Van Jones, for that matter, as socialists because they want government help in these ways. It's crazy, but it's out there in a big way. And if we don't all speak up about it and counter that to show how American it is to have our government invest in the people that live here in various ways and to remind people that their parents, their grandparents, their ancestors benefited a lot from government programs, whether it was homesteading or Social Security or the Federal Housing Administration loans. We really need to counter all that in order for this to happen.
I want to let people know just quickly where each one of you has oodles of information on your respective websites. This is the beginning of a discussion that we're having, and I couldn't find three more informative and sympathetic and bright sisters to do it with than Maejun Lui, director of the Closing the Racist Wealth Gap Initiative of the Insight Center for Community and Economic Development. And where can people get in touch with you and find out more about the organization, Maejun?
Well, I just have to say it is Closing the Racial Wealth Gap, although it is racist as well.
Well, okay.
So thank you for that. But it's insightcenter.org. Or insightcced.org, I'm sorry.
And Avis DeWeaver Jones, you are now the director of the National Council of Negro Women's Research, Public Policy and Information Center. Where can people find out more about the work that's being done there?
Thank you, and I always love being on. You can log on to our website at www.ncnw.org.
And Heidi Scherholz, labor market economist with the Economic Policy Institute. There's so much information available. Granted, a lot of it bleak, but things that we need to know in order to plow forward.
Mm-hmm. So it's epi.org. And we also have a program within EPI on race, ethnicity, and the economy. So in that section of the website, there's a lot of data and commentary on race, ethnicity, and economy. So there's a lot of stuff there.
There are so many initiatives and answers and good thoughts to doing what we must focus our attention on, which is the redistribution of the wealth,
absolutely,
shoring up the safety net, and creating those jobs, and more jobs. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.